Hello and welcome to Earth Hour Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food farm and garden edition that comes your way live every week here at 1 p.m. But we've changed our day to Wednesday now. We are going live on Wednesdays at 1 o'clock, making things a little better. We tend to have a lot of Living Web Farms workshops on Tuesdays, which we did last night. Great to see Ian Murphy, soil scientist there, author of the book Building Soil. Very exciting and engaging teacher there, talking about all of those variable dynamics that make very healthy soil, increased fertility, and how to build that up over time, how to make good estimates, how to measure. And, you know, in a lot of cases, it is just estimating, but we start to refine it. It's that combination of an art and a science, and it was a wonderful evening. So yes, we'll be going live on Wednesdays now, leaving more room on Tuesdays for jumping out to those great workshops. And of course, wonderful to see all the people there last night at the Mills River Educational Farm. Earth Hour Network Radio, this is the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition that comes your way each week. We will be joined today by Patrick Battle. He normally does join us at around 1:30, and we look forward to talking to him today again at that time and catching up on full motion spring activities, what to be doing. We have gotten a big start to spring around here. I mean, out of the blue, from freezing, icy, blizzardy conditions to turning up the heat to 50s, 60s, 70s, even 80s in the mountains over the last couple of weeks, and everything is blooming. It is like a total turbo spring turned up all the way. And it reminds me of that year in 2009 where we had this happen before Easter, and then we got hammered on Easter weekend and all the flowers got frozen. So I'm just hoping this does not happen again. I'm hoping we can keep on with a decent spring, not too many more shocking cold things happening. Just hoping for that, because it was so hard. It was so hard to see all of those little flowers and all of the bleeding hearts and all of those things just completely hammered. And at that point, there's no recovery. You're just out of your spring flowers for the year. So enjoying it. It's full activity time. Everything's sprouting. Everything is blooming up. And that means it's time to get your garden going. That means it's time to get it rolling along. And another thing you've got to be willing to look at nowadays is the fact that we are warmer and warmer and warmer. And we just finished with February, and guess what? Well, February has now broken another global temperature record by a shocking amount. Yes, this from The Guardian and MSN. Global temperatures in February smashed previous monthly records by an unprecedented amount. This is according to NASA data sparking warnings of climate emergency. Yes, the result was a true shocker, yet another reminder of the incessant long-term rise in global temperature. This person here, Jeff Masters and Bob Henson, say from human-produced greenhouse gases, yes, and the weather engineering programs that are going on that are obviously causing very much more extreme weather than we would even be having. Nature hasn't even heard of the kind of stuff we've been doing with humans in control of some of the weather, and you can read about it. It's been disclosed in various ways. You've just got to get informed. So double extremes, right? The extremes of climate plus humans thinking that they're smarter than nature, which of course does not work. So if we could just be learning from nature, we'd be a lot better off. But this hot, hot February confirms preliminary analysis from earlier in March indicating the record-breaking temperatures. Global surface temperatures across land and ocean in February were 1.35 Celsius degrees warmer than the average temperature for the month from the baseline period going from 1951 to 1980. The global record was set just 1 month earlier. Yes, every single month it's just hotter, 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 hotter. We are beating that much of the record by 1.15 centigrade above the average baseline. So what's happening with that? Well, we also have sea level rise happening, and it's going on at about 10 to 20 times more than we were told before. So sea level rise is also accelerating with these temperatures, and it is costing. It is costing people, and it will cost more and more all the way around the world in every coastal city. Every coastal city is going to see dramatic sea level rising in the next 10 to 20 years. Dramatic. 10, 20, 30, 40 feet. This is not, the waves are a little big today. No, we're talking about sea level rise, dramatic sea level rise in every coastal city. I think that's the big one on the horizon people aren't quite grasping yet. just how many people are going to be having to change location, move inland, do something different. And meanwhile, we've got things we can be doing. We can be sequestering more carbon, as he was saying last night there at the workshop. We can be having dynamic carbon sequestration. We can be covering the earth, as Ray Archuleta says, laying down those cover crop seeds. And this is one of my favorite lines from the workshop we did with him on diverse cover crops. Nature is not a nudist. Cover it up. That cracks me up for some reason. It's just so funny. Nature is not a nudist, right? You think of nature being, oh, natural, you know, all people that go out in nature and they jump, romp around without clothes. You know, you don't. Nature is not a nudist. No, nature covers up with plants and plant life, roots, all of the greenery that helps that dynamic carbon sequestration happen. That's how our atmosphere works, pumping that carbon into the ground. And we can be doing that. We can be changing this climate conversation, because right now we've got smashing Earth's all-time global heat records by a jaw-dropping margin. Right now, that's where we're at. We're standing on the edge of 100% catastrophic climate conditions. And we have the power to change it. We have the power to change the conversation. And that's why it's up to us to do everything we can and praise those awesome people out there, like Bill McKibben just the other day. Yes, arrested again by Schuyler County Sheriff for blocking a truck from entering Crestwood Seneca Lake methane gas storage facility. He's trying to get the word out about things that are going on. There's a fight going on over the fate of the Finger Lakes, receiving national attention as best-selling author, environmental founder, 350.org, Bill McKibben joined the opposition. McKibben's 55 years old. He was arrested last week after he was doing a little civil disobedience campaign against proposed gas storage in Seneca Lake's abandoned salt caverns. They want to take these amazing salt caverns and store horrendous toxic stuff in there. It's a developing story, but at this time, all people there have been released from this arrest, except Bill McKibben, which it's probably happened by now. But it's organized by the direct group We Are Seneca Lake. People forming a human blockade on the driveway of the gas storage and transportation company. During the blockade, they were blocking the traffic. They want to stand up because these places need to be protected. They're talking about holding off the fossil fuel industry for a few more years because it's not going to be rebuilt again. We've got to stand strong where there are still some bits of nature left before we use this unsustainable technology and burn up our whole atmosphere. And it's not going to be a lasting thing. Plus, then we already wrecked everything. And that's why Bill McKibben is standing up and saying something in this campaign. And this goes on thanks to ReaderSupportedNews.org here for carrying the story with Bill McKibben. And learn more about what you can do for direct information on more of what's going on with the climate and all of that. 350.org, a wonderful organization founded by Bill McKibben, someone who's willing to take action for what he cares about. And I encourage you to be one of those people. Take action on things you care about. We find out more and more every day things that are going on, things where we can make a big difference. And maybe, just maybe, we can preserve more of the sacred earth that we share than we are doing now. There are over 30 million hectares. There's all this land slated to be logged. There's all kinds of beautiful ocean areas and places that are slated to still be drilled, to still continue on the dead-end path and deadly path of burning fossil fuels in opposition to nature. It's time to work with nature and just keep those things in the ground and press the throttle on turbo economic development of clean, green, sustainable energy sources. Right now, enough of this anachronistic dinosaur days thinking of having to be exactly backwards with what makes sense. I love this earth and I love the people on it. And I love the creatures and the biodiversity and the great living web of all creation that we're here stewarding together. We're not here so a little handful of people can destroy it and cash it all in so everyone else is left with nothing. Of course, that's not what we're here to do, but that's what's going on. And we're watching indigenous people mowed down along with those forests. We're watching languages lost, ways of life lost, knowledge about sacred plants and herbs and nutritional things and healing things in nature. This is our divine matrix of absolute splendor. And here we are pillaging it still. We've already been doing it a long time and we're still doing it. The Amazon is still being chopped down. The Indonesian forests with endangered orangutans are very much looking to be wiped out. They're burning right now. It's up to us The world's on fire, and it's up to us to have the fire in our heart kindled peacefully, powerfully, positively, to help uplift each other, to create the sustainable world that we all want to share together. And so that's the spirit in which I share this intense news. It's a spirit of, yes, let's do something, right? Not let's sit on our hands and complain about it. Complaining actually causes all kinds of ways of thinking in the brain that you don't even want to participate. You don't even want to be a complainer, right? We don't even want to be just out there whining about everything. It doesn't do any good. Doesn't do any good at all. All it does is bring people down. So what we want to do, we want to go ahead and learn about sometimes the ugly truth, sometimes the inspiring truth. But once we learn, then we can take empowered action. We can start to make real difference. Sometimes it's incremental. Sometimes it's these tiny little steps that are just almost incoherently meaningful. Like, wow, how does that make a difference? Well, guess what? Every single step in the right direction counts. Every single one. Whether we're making it on a personal level or whether we're making it on a planetary level. As an example, my son loves salmon. And I mean, he loves salmon. Since he was a baby, he loves salmon. And I was happy to recently be able to get some sustainably harvested salmon. But, you know, you've got to watch out. You're cruising along in the grocery store and things are packaged up so beautifully and there's nice bright colors injected into things to make them look attractive. But that might not be the truth about that food product. What does it really look like? What's really in there, right? What do those mysterious chemical ingredients truly mean for your health or your lack of it? Bad news, right? Well, guess what? Here's a new one for you. Salmon, right? Salmon that was caught near one of the biggest salmon fishing areas near Seattle has now been found to be inundated with antidepressants, cocaine, and more. Yes, humans once again contaminating the natural world and then thus poisoning ourselves. Not exactly great news, right? But doesn't it make you want to check what quality of salmon you might be eating if you're still eating that stuff? And please stop eating tuna. If you're still eating tuna, it's packed with mercury. The tuna are totally endangered. I don't even know how they can be providing tuna on grocery shelves all over the country when there's so many, and the tuna are just so endangered. So it's full of heavy metals because of toxicity going on in the ocean. Forget about the tuna, okay? But as far as salmon, it's getting dicier and dicier all the time. Puget Sound, yes, it's drug contamination. We've got people out there like want-to-be presidential candidates Ted Cruz going all in for companies like Monsanto, insulting tens of millions of health-conscious Americans, calling, let's call out those anti-science zealots, people that don't even pay attention to what's actually going on. And we've got the new head of the FDA beholden to pharmaceutical companies. We've got problems. We've got contamination on all levels. So, you know, especially when we come to overusing drugs and putting drugs out there and then people flush their drugs down the toilets, they don't want it, they don't finish prescriptions, whatever it is. People are overprescribed, they're urinating, all these drugs are going into our water supply. So even if you don't take pharmaceutical drugs like me, then you're still possibly getting them in your food, getting them in your salmon. It is disgusting. So there are many ingredients that poison our brain. There are lots of things out there that are contaminants, including neurotoxins like the mercury in the tuna. Now we found out that feminine hygiene products have cancer-causing glyphosate herbicide. I'm talking about female hygiene products that go into some very, very, the most private place that a human being female has. Oh yeah, there's glyphosate in that tampon. Can you imagine? And here we are eating organic food and maybe we're inserting a glyphosate tampon. The level of unconscious action in our consumer markets is almost inconceivable. So I encourage you, look deeper behind your labels, whatever it is you're eating or putting in your body in any form, even if it's on your skin. Read deeper, dare to care, dare to find out, and make a better choice. You know, this drug-laden, cocaine-filled, antidepressant, poison salmon is still costs a whole lot. It's not cheaper. It's not on sale because it's bad. So you might as well read. You might as well get your money's worth and protect your health. Wow. Really, it's so preposterous what's going on a mass scale. So it's really up to us to put on our thinking caps, our reading glasses, get out those dictionaries that don't exist and, you know, that describe all these terms. I don't know if there is a dictionary that describes all of the very confusing food chemical terms. There's probably one for grocery manufacturers somewhere, but we've got to really be able to look up things. You actually have to know chemistry to read food labels appropriately. You have to actually know about chemistry, because there are so many compounds combined that by the time you read them, you don't know what it means if you don't know the chemistry terminology, you know, phrases and things that mean certain things. Okay, this means this was combined with this molecule, etc. You know, you have to be somewhat of a little researcher to really even know what you're eating these days. And because it's not going to be labeled, it's not going to say, wow, filled with cocaine and antidepressants right on the label of that salmon. Right? It takes being informed, people like me telling you about it, maybe, or reading on your own, getting out there, pounding the news sources for relevant information. Yes, we've got all kinds of things going on out there. We've got the statin, cholesterol drugs. Yes, those cause rapid aging, brain damage, and diabetes. Yes, that's out there being contaminated into our water supply, so we can all share that. I don't want to share this stuff, right? I want to share the good in the world, building sustainable culture, growing organic food, helping each other, uplifting communities, not sharing in all this toxicity. But we can't help it. When we toxify somewhere, it ends up everywhere, or at least spreading everywhere eventually. Now we've got the FDA getting ready to declassify electroshock therapy to same risk category as condoms and contact lenses. How about that? Ready for some electroshock now? I mean, the level of nonsensical that goes on, we've got to have our wits about us. We've got to get a hold of ourselves, and we've got to be well-researched, thoroughly informed, and consistently inspired. Companies are out there working hard to get us addicted to all kinds of products. They're using addictive substances in products. This is going on. Then we've got people trying to clamp down on natural medicine, on the God-given natural things that grow on the earth, the natural herbs like comfrey, and even the foods like cinnamon, and the foods we eat that are medicinal like maca, and, you know, wonderful foods. I mean, food and medicine are the same, not these concocted, patented things with tons of side effects. Those aren't medicines. Those are pharmaceutical drugs that are unethically produced and should not even be poisoning our water supply, poisoning the salmon that you can buy at the grocery store. Wow. How do we ever filter this out in the environment? Well, we do it by reducing the amount of contaminants to begin with, and then we start doing whatever filtration we can. Again, working with gardens and plant life to transform what's in the soil, to try to really be careful to have good filtration on our water systems. We've seen that out in Flint, Michigan, of course, the entire population there being poisoned by their governor, who authorized switching to a very corrosively contaminated water source. Meanwhile, guess what they were doing over there at the governor's office? They were bringing in bottled water while no one else knew that they were being poisoned. They knew, and they were bringing in bottled water for themselves. So can we leave it up to, oh, the governor will take care of us, or the whoever? No, right? We've got to be proactive. Maybe we help them in the end. You know, we've got to be part of a team that makes sense, not just looking to someone else, giving all our power away, and being completely ignorant. That just doesn't work. So it's up to us, as usual, every day. We've got wonderful things going on, and we've got to be able to see how we can interact. But yes, you know, we hear all these horror stories. Oh, people are on drugs. You know, isn't that awful? Get people off drugs, juveniles stealing drugs and things like that. And normally it's people that are involved taking drugs, not fish. Well, now you can pick up salmon, and the Chinook salmon there, just say no. We've got 80 different drugs being found. This disturbing new research has indicated young salmon found in the Puget Sound tested positive for more than 80 different pharmaceutical drugs, including cocaine, antidepressants, dozens of other medications used by humans. When researchers tested the water near sewage treatment plants in the estuaries of Puget Sound near Seattle, they discovered high levels of drugs and personal care products, You know, where does all that junk go, right? That we wash down the drains at some of the highest contaminations found anywhere in our nation. The tissues of migratory Chinook salmon and local staghorn sculpin also contain these compounds, even in the fish found in estuaries far away from the sewage treatment plants where the water was previously considered pristine. Well, you look at it, it looks beautiful. Gorgeous, majestic nature. Oh, it's so pristine out way out here. It's so far away. Until you do the test. As reported by the Seattle Times, the medicine chest of common drugs also included Flonase, Aleve, Tylenol, Paxil, Valium, Zoloft, Tagamet, Oxycontin, Darvon, nicotine and caffeine, fungicides, antiseptics, anticoagulants, and Cipro and other antibiotics galore, killing the biology in our gut and in nature. Why are the levels so high? Well, because people there in that area are using more of the drugs detected, or it could be related to wastewater treatment plants and the processes that are lacking. But those sewage treatment plants aren't able to cope with what's going on. They're not able to fully remove the chemicals. They have inferior filtration going on right now. And, you know, we can argue for some of the value of some pharmaceuticals, but in the overarching truth of the matter, as we see in those commercials, you get one little symptom suppressed and you get this huge laundry list of negative effects, side effects that are not intended, that are awful. And the same is true with their interaction with our environment. We're simultaneously poisoning ourselves and our surroundings. It's time for another approach. It's time for another approach. Thank you, naturalnews.com, for this story. Mike Adams, Health Ranger out there, doing his best to bring information, to test water for lead, to test with his great laboratory, all kinds of things. We've got to start cleaning up and quit spewing into our environment and not be so unconscious in the process of our own destruction. Can we not wake up? Of course we can. Of course we can. And now again, another troubling climate milestone, but we need to be able to move along and look at how we can work better at it. What we've got is we have the temperatures going up, but meanwhile, we've got mercury contamination happening with power plants. We've got methane being released as the ice recedes because we have record-breaking levels of ice melting all around the Arctic. And of course, there's more oil up there. This week, we were happy to hear the announcement from President Obama just yesterday or the day before, I think, that we're not going to be drilling off the Atlantic. Thank goodness, over 100 coastal communities here said, no, we don't want oil drilling all over the Atlantic. We already have enough going on out there, and we don't want to destroy wildlife and destroy our communities. But, oh, let's do a little swap and change. Oh, well, could do more drilling then in the Gulf and a little more drilling up in the Arctic. No, that's not a good idea. When we sit here and we switch out one horrible thing for a few other horrible things, that's not really progress. And so, you know, real progress looks a little different than that. And that's what I would like to see. But we really need to stop doing the drilling for fossil fuels in a bigger way all around the world while we aggressively pursue the cleaner, greener energy sources that we have here to develop. And so, thank goodness, we're not going to be drilling on the North Carolina coast or the Eastern Seaboard. We're not going to be doing that now, but then we're going to be drilling more in other very sensitive areas that are already endangered. Right now, we've got naval tests going on. We've got explosions. We've got marine wildlife washing up. And, of course, Fukushima is still going on. And I really, really, really was saddened to see one of the most horrible pictures I've ever seen in my life a couple of days ago. And, yes, I got very upset when I saw it. Is Siamese twin double-headed dolphins and whales washing up on shore that are born in those radioactive waters. We've got totally mutating wildlife. We've got just absolutely decimating wildlife in addition to mutilating and causing the mutations. And then meanwhile, we've got companies going in the wrong direction here and there. Companies like Whole Foods. Do we really want to be thinking that we can put a label on something in a store that says, oh, this is great, this is natural, and then meanwhile we're supporting the same poison that's contaminating our environment? This just came out very recently. The USDA is forcing Whole Foods to accept Monsanto. Does this make Whole Foods just another grocery store? Well, If you don't stand for what you're for, then the silence is deadly too. The silence is just as awful. If you don't speak up when you're watching something bad going on, then you're right there in with the ones that are doing it, frankly. And that's why I talk about all this so much, because I want to make sure that even though I'm just one person, just like each of us, that I tried to help inform and inspire folks. And you know what? We do what we can. And even a company can do what they can. They can stand together as a more powerful force sometimes than they do when they cave into industry pressure. In the wake of a 12-year battle to keep Monsanto's genetically engineered crops from contaminating the nation's 25,000 organic farms and ranches, America's organic consumers and producers are now facing a betrayal, a self-appointed cabal of the organic elite spearheaded by Whole Foods Market, Organic Valley, and Stonyfield Farm has decided it's time to surrender to some of the demands to give in to Monsanto. Top executives from these companies have publicly admitted they no longer oppose the mass commercialization of genetically engineered crops, such as Monsanto's controversial Roundup Ready alfalfa, and are prepared to sit down and cut a deal for coexistence with Monsanto and USDA biotech cheerleader Tom Vilsack. Now, there is no peaceful coexistence with these genetically engineered crops. They contaminate and ruin the organic crops. They contaminate the soil. They contaminate other crops. And they are poison. They are covered in more poisons than we were ever told they were going to be. And they kill our pollinators, including endangered monarchs and tons of bees. And what do those bees do? Well, they pollinate a big part of our food supply. So there is no peaceful coexistence. There is no deal to cut with deadly products. They need to be banned, like they're banning them in France, like they're banning them around the world. We've got things making sense in 38 countries that are banning or limiting the ability for GMOs to be distributed, for them to be grown. Ireland is banning them all over the world. People are making great sense. But somehow here, we've got these blinders on, and we've got the corruption going on, and we've got the lobbying going on, and millions and billions of dollars being spent in corporate interest that is totally anti-life. How about being pro-life and for everything, real pro-life, right? Pro-life for not only unborn babies when it's a good, healthy situation. You know, women can die in childbirth. So people that say only pro-life, you know, I've known people that died. It can be horrible, right? In the past, a lot more women did die during that. And sometimes there's medical reasons. But in the general sense, pro-life on earth is what we've all got to be on the side of. Not some very limited idea of it. We've got anti-life stuff going on in every direction. And meanwhile, we're living organisms here trying to have fun, have a good time, and do our best, right? When we're doing our best. And meanwhile, oh, let's cut a deal with this totally destructive company that's on trial for crimes against humanity, lied for 40 years about the carcinogenicity of its main product, Roundup, and oh, we're going to cut a deal now? In a cleverly worded but profoundly misleading email sent to its customers about 3 weeks ago, Whole Foods Market, while proclaiming their support for organics and seed purity, gave the green light to USDA bureaucrats to approve the conditional deregulation of Monsanto's genetically engineered herbicide-resistant alfalfa. Beyond the regulatory euphemism of conditional deregulation, this means that WFM and their colleagues, the Whole Foods Market, are willing to go along with the massive planting of a chemical and energy-intensive genetically engineered perennial crop guaranteed to spread its mutant seeds and genes across the nation, guaranteed to contaminate the alfalfa fed to organic animals, guaranteed to lead to mass poisoning of farm workers and destruction of the essential soil food web by the toxic herbicide Roundup, and guaranteed to produce Roundup-resistant superweeds that require even more deadly herbicides. This is just a death spiral. This is just a death spiral. When you do a deal with a death spiral kind of a product, it just gets worse and worse and worse. The only reason they're even doing this deal is because they were standing for something once. And now they're giving in. Now they're having the conversation. Okay, all right, we'll roll over. This is all in exchange for a new assault on farm workers and rural communities. A recent large-scale Swedish study found spraying Roundup doubles farm workers and rural residents' risk of getting cancer. Whole Foods Market expects the pro-biotech USDA to begin to regulate rather than cheerlead for Monsanto in payment for a broad new spectrum attack on the soil's crucial ability to provide nutrition for food crops and to sequester dangerous greenhouse gases? We know that Roundup devastates essential soil microorganisms that provide plant nutrition and sequester climate-destabilizing greenhouse gases. We know this. And meanwhile, we're cutting a deal. According to informed sources, the CEOs of Whole Foods Market and Stonyfield Farms are personal friends of former Iowa governor, now USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack, and in fact made financial contributions to Vilsack's previous electoral campaigns. Vilsack was hailed as governor of the year in 2001 by the Biotechnology Industry Organization. So they started to recognize him and now have vaulted him to the position he's in now at the USDA. They also traveled in a Monsanto corporate jet on his campaign trail. I mean, he's like this total poster child for this deadly company. And now that's who's head of our United States Department of Agriculture. And they're friends with these people that say they're for organic, and now we're cutting these dirty deals. Perhaps even more fundamental to Organic Inc.'s abject surrender is the fact that the organic elite has become more and more isolated from the concerns and passions of organic consumers and locavores. So it's up to us little local grassroots people and farmers markets and schools and children, people that are in community gardens, people that care, to lift our voices to companies like Stonyfield and Whole Foods Market. Apparently, they think the battle against GMOs has been lost. Meanwhile, progress is being made around the world. It's not time to reach for the consolation prize. It's time to really go for it. It's time to make strides here. It's time to get truly getting this on the right track. Time to go along with the research that makes sense, that is actually done by credible sources to understand what we're facing here. It's like, okay, we get to put poison stuff out, so it's going to ruin everyone else's non-poison stuff. So unethical, it's almost incomprehensible. No consolation prizes, no deadly deals with poison. There is no peaceful coexistence with poisons being spewed in our environment that are carcinogenic and totally toxic and cause tons of health problems for the soil and for us. There's no happy, you know, ending to that. There's no happy trail there to hop along together. That is the death spiral. That's what this is all about. It's a death spiral of disastrous proportions. So no coexistence with behemoth poison companies and the organic community can really exist. Lulling the public to sleep and greenwashing the unpleasant fact that Monsanto's unlabeled and unregulated genetically engineered crops are now spreading their toxic genes across the globe and in hundreds of millions of acres of cropland. That's what's going on. The main reason that they're pleading for coexistence and all of these biotech bullies is that they're desperately wanting the controversy surrounding genetically engineered food and crops just to go away. Why? Because they know, just as we do, that there are billions of dollars in sales derived from so-called natural processed foods and animal products that are contaminated with GMOs. There's a big, big amount of money being made on this stuff. And I dare say there would be a lot more money being made if it was not contaminated. So these so-called natural products, these unlabeled toxic products that are out there, are making money. Oh, let's just pretend that this issue doesn't exist anymore. Somehow it's okay. Natural products are out there containing non-organic corn and soy, genetically modified, all contaminated, in contrast to their certified organic products, which are basically free of GMOs. And approximately two-thirds of the products sold by Whole Foods Market and their main distributor, United Natural Foods International, are not certified organic, but rather are conventional, chemical-intensive, and GMO-tainted foods and products disguised as natural. Well, sorry, nature does not splice genes that way. So they're not natural. That's actually, you know, we all know in the food industry, if you don't know, natural is a totally meaningless term. It's just a marketing ploy. It is not natural. And natural doesn't have to mean natural when it's on the label, so you just forget if it says natural. Maybe it makes you feel a little better, but read the label. And if it's not organic, it is not natural. Okay. Unprecedented wholesale and retail control of the organic marketplace by UNFI and Whole Foods, employing a business model of selling twice as much so-called natural food as certified organic food, coupled with the takeover of many organic companies by multinational food corporations, threatens the growth of the organic movement on the mass scale. Covering up GMO contamination is perpetrating natural fraud. Many well-meaning consumers are confused, and people are ignorant enough as it is and uninformed. I mean, it's not hard to confuse them. They're very confused about the difference between conventional products marked as natural, i.e., it means nothing, okay, just have to go for the organic label, and those nutritionally, environmentally superior, and climate-friendly products that are certified organic. People don't always know the difference. And that's why I keep sounding this drum. Just choose organic food. Grow more of your own food so that you can afford more organic food. Whatever you do, just eat organic food. Retail stores like Whole Foods Market and wholesale distributors like UNFI have failed to educate their customers about the qualitative difference between natural and certified organic. They have a vested interest in doing that, keeping business rolling along as usual. They've been expanding. Whole Foods Market has opened 2 new stores in Asheville alone. Never mind all over the country. Their expanding business model relies on that $9 billion in sales that is distributed to help support everything they're doing. They're relying on the backs of these genetically engineered products to be able to make the money to continue their business model. It's a conflict of interest. There's money to be made by not disclosing the whole truth here. There's money to be made. And of course, it doesn't mean it's going to be great for them or everyone, but they haven't exactly pointed out the qualitative differences here. And meanwhile, we've got confined feeding operations producing toxic meats that are also for sale at Whole Foods Market. And you get the GMOs thrown in too, along with lots of antibiotics and other things. A very troubling trend in organics today is the calculated shift on the part of certain large formerly organic brands from certified organic ingredients and products to so-called natural ingredients. So what we have is we have lots of big organic companies out there, big ones. I mean, there's a whole map of it, and it's quite disturbing to look at, of all these organic companies that have been bought out by non-organic, very conventional, very toxic companies, and now we're getting rid of the organic, and we're just going with natural, which is meaningless, and then they've got much less quality ingredients, but they're still selling for those premium prices and using those brand names, but then they are now denuded and no longer organic. So that's what's going on, with the exception of one sector, the grass-fed and grass-finished meat sector. Most natural, quote-unquote, natural meat and dairy and eggs coming from the animals reared on GMO grains and drugs and confined entirely or for a good portion of their lives. We've got some progress happening in that area. We've got more grass-fed going on, but that still doesn't mean organic. These labels are very confusing. Nothing means organic non-GMO unless it's organic, okay? Now, there is another label that is the non-GMO certified, right? You see the little monarch butterfly, the non-GMO certified label. That means non-GMO, but it does not mean non-poison. It's still got pesticides. It's still got conventional pesticides. So really being informed, you know, people, I just want to eat whatever I want to eat. I don't have to worry about all this stuff. Well, that's the definition of unconsciousness, okay? We need to be aware of what we're eating. And in the way olden days, right, with humans out there foraging and just learning about cooking and fire and all that, boy, if you didn't look out what you were eating, you could die of food poisoning or something. And it's still today, it just happens a lot slower. The poisoning of our gut, the gut dysbiosis, the epidemic rates of digestive problems and all of these things, it's a slow motion death with lots of misery and symptoms and quality of life just sinking and sinking and sinking. It is a cumulative effect. But meanwhile, if you get away from that stuff, boom, your body does its job. Kidneys filter stuff out. The liver works. The gut gets back in shape. You get your microbes working, your immune system functioning. And next thing you know, your body gets rid of it. If you can manage not to drink it in your groundwater or keep eating it somehow through unconscious things that you're consuming. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal when a large company like this fails us, when big organizations fail the consumers. Organic consumers are increasingly left without certified organic choices, and genuine organic farmers and ranchers are losing market share to natural imposters. That's what's going on. Oh, I'll just buy the natural one. It's so much cheaper than that organic one. Right, but it's much more expensive when you factor in the cost of your health. So it's no wonder less than 1% of American farmland is certified organic. While well-intentioned but misled consumers have boosted organic and natural purchases to $80 billion annually, approximately 12% of all grocery store sales are now organic or natural. But unfortunately, people are mixing those up, right? They are not the same. The solution, Truth in Labeling, can help enable customers to drive so-called natural GMO and CAFO-tainted foods off the market. But I'm not waiting around for labels. Encourage everyone you know to eat organic food. Because there is no coexistence with a reckless industry that undermines public health, destroys biodiversity, damages the environment, tortures and poisons animals, destabilizes the climate, economically devastates the world's 1.5 billion seed-saving small farmers. There's no such thing as wonderful, happy little coexistence by sweeping this awful thing under the rug. There's no coexistence between GMOs and organic farms in the European Union. Why? Because the EU there are almost no GMO crops under cultivation. They have smartened up more than we have here. Nor GM consumer food products on the supermarket shelves. They are banned. Why not here? They've got it. They've got it going on, and they're helping. They're helping people make better choices. And why is this? Because under EU law, all foods containing GMOs or GMO ingredients must be labeled. Consumers have the freedom to choose or not to choose GMOs, while farmers, food processors, and retailers have, at least legally, the right to lace foods with GMOs as long as they are safety tested and labeled. Now, safety testing doesn't really mean it's safe. Of course, the EU food industry understands that consumers, for the most part, do not want to purchase or consume genetically engineered foods. So, if you put a label, you're putting a skull and crossbones on it. They know that. And that's why we don't have labels here. Because people wouldn't want to buy the junk that is for sale, that is contaminated. That's why you've got to stick up for organic. Great article there from Herbal House 365. Fantastic, in-depth article here. And great to see that from the admin there. Just out. Great story if you want to read the whole thing at herbalhouse365.com. Earth Art Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition. So glad to be here with you. Spring is in full swing. Get that garden growing. Get those seeds in order. Get those cruciferous vegetables planted. It's time. If you cover them with a little row cover and plastic, even when another possible potential snowstorm comes before this is all done with and spring is truly in full swing, you can still keep those things going. Get some stuff in the ground this week. It's going to be a great one. We're so excited to see things sprouting everywhere. And, of course, it's always fun to see the whole farm sprouting again in springtime as well. We look forward to a whole year of wonderful workshops there at Living Web Farms, one as last night. This Saturday, we've got Jim Elizondo with Graziers Intensive. This is part three of regenerative and sustainable ranching methods that you will be very excited to learn about. If you can attend in person, please do. That registration is open at livingwebfarms.org. And then we will have all three of those series, Graziers Intensive Part 1, 2, and 3, online at livingwebfarms.org coming up. Well, we've got lots of things happening. Sometimes staying informed can be somewhat of a painful process because of how things go and what we see, and obviously very, very odd things going on, even opposite of what would seem to be required. And we were off the air for a few weeks, and one of the stories I wanted to share with you was the new confirmation of Robert Califf for the FDA, and he is very beholden in the pharmaceutical industry. So just another upside-down thing out there. But what we can focus on is what's green and growing. Spring happening, of course. Winter's still lingering. But we have Patrick Battle with us now for This Week in the Garden to give us, well, I guess that turbo blast into what is the time to really get things going, right, Pat? At least most things.
Oh, it is flat-out time. We've hit it. You know, when it's warm like this, it's flat-out time with fear. in our bones as we fear a deep cold coming. We have to take advantage of the weather, but we may have to offer a bunch of protection if it suddenly plunges back into really cold weather. You know, indeed, Marshall, I just was wanting to be on the phone with you on the air with you sooner today, but I was going over planting onions, which we have to take advantage of this weather and get them in the ground. And we really have to be, you know, he was like, why don't we just wait? Because I'm saying, you know, this Friday and Saturday, they're saying 38. 38 is no big deal. But if they say on Friday that they decided it might be 34, that means in our garden it could be 28. And 28 for these recently in the greenhouse onions will be way too cold. So we're going to have to hit them with row cover. Cover them with row cover. We never use the bulbs. The bulbs are so prone to bolting, and we don't get a good selection of onions that way. We want to grow things like Bridger, Cabernet, you know, ones that we know do really well for us. So we always start our plants, you know. Then we have to protect them.
Right, you know? Right. You were saying last night, even if it gets to be another cold, some plastic and row cover can pretty much probably get through. And keep those things safe. But it sure is beautiful watching the mountains fully come alive. It's like all the bloom buttons are hitting at once almost.
See, I'm not too worried for the tomatoes. I mean, the onions, rather. We can save them. We know what to do. But we can't save the fruit trees, you know. We can't save the blossom, stuff like that. So, you know, when I talked to Jeremy for the first time as I was coming back from Florida, he's like, Pat, it's so warm, it's scaring me.
It was. I was shocked. It got so warm so quickly. That's why I wrote you, it is unbelievably warm here. And, I mean, it's like almost like things having to bloom unnaturally fast. I mean, just pow, just explosions of blooms
they
everywhere.
They are totally pushed wide open. And, indeed, you know, this was like the famous Easter freeze back in, I think it was probably 2009 or 2000, something like that. I mean, it was like this. And then at the end of the month, right at Easter, it plunged back into the teens. And literally all over Western North Carolina, because I did my radio show on WCQS then, people called in because they all wanted to know what to do about the fact that their Japanese maples were all dead. I mean, it killed some plants dead, you know, and it knocked other plants way back, you know, like they might have lived, but yet for landscape plants, you were cutting back and pruning most of the top growth off, you know, and any vegetables that were out, if you couldn't give them the protection, they were gone, you know. And so that's what we're hoping doesn't happen. You know, you stay here, we're probably going to be pushing the high 70s today. And then if all of a sudden a big cold front comes in and we plunge back into the teens, that's where death happens, you know. I was saying to somebody last night, you know, if it goes into the high 20s, row cover, probably no damage at all. Mid-20s, row cover, probably a little bit of whitening here and there where plants froze slightly, you know. Use plastic, no damage at all. Gets down in the low 20s, you better have plastic on too or there's going to be damage to those new transplants, you know. Get down in the teens with row cover and plastic, you'll see a little bit of that whitening. You'll still see some damage, but your plants, if they have any ability to be hardy, will make it, you know. Uncovered, excuse me, anything below 25 is going to start showing serious damage, you know, and 25 is going to show some damage. So we just have to be ready to cover. I mean, there's no choice. You have to seize the moment. The soil, you know, it's warm and windy and dry. The soil's going to dry out. We could get cool again. It could rain. You may miss. This might be the window to get onions, peas, potatoes, brassicas that you've got starts for, spinach that you're sowing direct from seed. All those things should be happening right now, you know. And then just you have to accept that you may have to protect them. But if you're a grower and you're trying to accomplish a lot, you can't give up a window like this, you know. We have to seize the opportunities, and then we have to be ready to deal with the fact that nature may decide to laugh in our face and make us work harder. But we have to go for it.
Well, here we are, Pat. I just thought while you were saying all that to look up the extended forecast on AccuWeather. They tend to have a pretty good extended forecast, and I don't see anything below 50 degrees for the rest of the month here.
At nighttime temperatures?
Correct. I'm seeing, you know, a low. Actually, lows around 31 is the lowest one, and then we've got a high. Our lowest high is 50 degrees.
Yeah, see, okay, the daytime temperatures are meaningless. We don't care about that. It's
right.
That nighttime.
31.
That nighttime 31. And, you know, 31, it's already, they've already lowered it. They were saying 38 a couple of days ago, and they do this all the time. The closer we get to the cold event, the colder they predict. So we could be in trouble. That 31 could end up at 25, which in this garden right here, which is a bowl, means 21. We're going to need to cover like crazy. We're going to even need to put plastic over, you know?
Today, we're at the 16th, and then we're looking as we go through the week here, we're going from today near 80 to over to 70 tomorrow, and then we're looking at in the mid-60s by Friday, and then the mid-50s, and then down to 50 by the 20th, and that's where we've got the 36, low average, but maybe around 31. So that's coming over with some drizzle over the next several days. But, you know, then we're moving back into the 80s and then really not doing much with super low temperatures. So quite amazing. Yeah, I don't see a cold spell coming on, at least for the month of March yet.
See, that one night, though, could be critical. I mean, it'll be great if it cools off slowly. If we have nights that are plunging into the low 40s and then into the high 30s and then into the mid 30s, then our danger is way less because the plants will harden off. All these plants can take cold, you know. But for us, when they say 31, that's a likely 25 because we're at the bottom of everything and we're way colder than anybody else, you know. And so that means we will be covering a bunch of stuff, you know. And that's the way it is. We're in terror not of the general trend. The trend we know is warm. That's why we have to seize it and plant. But that cold night could totally set us back, you know? And so we have to be preparing for that all the time.
Well, it was certainly awesome. Again, the 23rd Annual Organic Grower School over the weekend. Hope you're feeling better. I know you were getting through that cold and everything, but it was so wonderful to meet so many people. And then, of course, our workshop last night. Then we've got one coming up this Saturday and a whole year of great workshops to attend. What is your main tip for spring that you think people really just need to be reminded of, Pat, as far as remembering about organic gardening and getting the season going? What's the big foundational sort of tip that you would think of to give people? Because sometimes just getting off to the right start can make all the difference.
I'd say the number one tip, you know, it'll vary as I go through the season. But for right now, it's like use the tools we've given you in videos like What Ground to get it in the ground now. Do not think, oh, I got to wait to get that guy with the tractor to come till up my whole garden when the soil's well good enough shape to do it. If you want to have continuous food from now on, pick a corner, do lasagna beds, do the various systems we've shown, till it, mow it to the nubs, plant in the hole in well-amended hole, and then come back and mulch like crazy with leaves and then remulch to kill that cover crop. But get it in the ground. Create the ground. You know, look at that video. Figure out the different ways to create the ground. If you were really on top of it and caught our radio shows last fall, you picked a few beds and you mulched them out. So right now you can just pull that mulch back and plant. You know, so many things: beets, peas, spinach, collards, kale. All of them depend on an early cool start if you want to get a great spring garden. You know, you'll have no trouble getting the soil prepared to do your springtime planting for your summer garden. But if you want that spring garden, you've got to be creative and dynamic and get it in the ground now. Seize the moment. That is my advice. Seize the moment, but fear the deep cold and be ready for it. That's my advice.
Okay. Well, it's certainly time. It's like we're sitting here and it's icy and blizzardy and scraping ice off the windshield. And then you turn around and it's all, whoom, here it is.
That is the nature of it. Totally. I mean, that's how it is. I mean, our agenda, we got two people away right now, and our agenda is seedlings. We're doing a bunch of trials with a potting soil we've tried to use for years. It's become inconsistent. So I'm in the greenhouse trying each bag separately to decide if we can trust a pallet full of this stuff. Marshall's trying to get onions in. Rocco's trying to keep up with harvest. We got to come back together tomorrow, work up soil for Mark Dempsey's grain class. We need to get those early grains, the oats, the barley, and stuff like that in the ground. We've got to prepare soil and put potatoes in the ground. We got to prepare soil and get peas in the ground. It is just flat out, you know. And that's the time of year, you know. And boy, are we seizing the moment. Everybody's working longer than 8 hours a day right now. You know, we don't work as many hours in the winter, but we are flat out right now.
It's like if we could just double ourselves, just clone ourselves for this little period, it would be so convenient. But instead, we just get the rest and then to jump into action as nature is doing and really just open it wide up. And it's great to see. So I can't wait to see the gardens blooming again at the farm. That's always such a beautiful sight. And, of course, cover crops growing and getting that next year's harvest along the path of growth. Are we going to be helping with some seedlings with Lord's Acre again this year?
Oh, yeah, we're starting seedlings. I think we've got about five gardens that we just start them for them flat out. And then I got permission for other gardens that are now asking, we really don't have enough labor to keep starting them, but if they come over and do the labor, we can provide the materials, and I'll work my off hours to guide them. And they can, you know, we can grow plants. We have enough greenhouse space. We just don't have the people power to keep starting all these seedlings, you know, because more and more of the gardens that give are asking us to help them, and we don't want to say no, you know.
Well, I love it that we have all the tools, though, because, you know, with like your video seed starting and also seedling production, when they are getting that skill level, right? So we're not just giving out the fish, we're teaching the folks to fish or garden, as it were, and being able to really get those skills engaged, and then they can utilize the video as well. And then we help along with some of the seedlings and the space in there. Then that's a perfect way to really launch the learning and expanding the knowledge base there at those community gardens too. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. It's powerful, and the testimonies we've had. I think we've quoted some of them on the air. I mean, like, you know, Black Mountain Garden last year said we helped them to close their food gap by 2 months because they had plants they could put them out earlier and get it and put them in later and have, you know, instead of 8 months a year feeding food, they get 10 months, you know. That's huge, you know. That's powerful. We're really honored and privileged to be able to help with that, you know. It's special. I wanted to mention, Lisa, Jeff Poppin's workshop this weekend, because we're going to have him come here, and I'm hoping some farmers are listening. I really think that people want to catch Jeff Poppin if they're farmers. And, you know, I say that while I have to admit that he doesn't do it like we do it at all. He's got an utterly different approach. We are more and more moving to no-till, and he has a rigorous tillage and cultivation plan. It's very savvy. It's a biodynamic grower who understands soil ecology. You know, he uses a chisel plow, which goes down low and just opens up these like channels in the soil. And he's got biodynamic compost. He makes large amounts of it. He has a lot of animals. And we would consider it a lousy composting process, but he uses these biodynamic preps and time, and he gets very good compost, and he uses his nose to spot the anaerobic places that haven't worked, and he pulls that aside, and he spreads abundant compost out on the ground, and then chisel plows it in so it falls into these channels. He waits and lets the biology loosen the soil up, comes back and chisel plows it again, and then plants, and then he uses rotary hoes, harrows, and other tools that work like hoes in a small garden to ensure that weeds don't come up. And he does that when the soil is dried out enough after a rain that he can create a layer of fluffy, dry soil. He calls it dust mulching. He uses no irrigation whatsoever. And he's growing 100,000 pounds of food on a lot of land and using tractors for all of it. It's very different from us, but he's using old-timey tractors, very inexpensive tools, and it's a sustainable model for, you know, beginning farmers that can't afford like a $14,000, $20,000 no-till seed drill, or a, you know, $3,000 roller, or a 100-horsepower tractor that can push, that can handle that kind of thing. You know, he's using old-timey low-horsepower tractors. He's got a bunch of them, but very different growing. But I'm sure he's growing wonderful food. And I'm very tempted, you know, to look at isolating a few acres here and trying that method too, so we can compare the what it does to the soil and talk about it, you know. If I just heard without listening to all the details of what he did and getting that he was aware of the soil ecology, I would think that our soil would be so much better. But I don't know that it will be. He's got one theory. He uses no sources of nitrates. That's things like chicken, you know, pasteurized chicken litter, or feather meal, or fish meal, our seaweed, our fish emulsion. He uses none of them. He thinks that that readily available nitrate actually creates weak plants that are vulnerable to disease. So he counts on his cover crops and fluffing the air, the soil up so much that air can penetrate it, and then having the incredible diversity that the biodynamic preps create so that other microbes besides rhizobia, you know, the inoculant we put on legumes, other microbes are actually helping to get the nitrogen from the air and get nitrogen to those plants. I'm not even sure how that works. It fascinates me. I tried to get Aya to talk about it last night, but it was way, way too much for that workshop, you know. She's fascinated too. But it's the kind of thing where it's like, okay, now I got to go back to zero and look at another whole system. And I don't think I'll ever decide that no-till isn't a major piece of the future. But for farmers that need to make a living in the hard world of farming and have the resources, the land, and can afford some equipment, it may be a very viable, sustainable way to become a farmer, grow a lot of food, and stay in business. And it's actually pretty major that he's not using water for irrigation, because we are being profligate with our water resources, probably more profligate and more likely to hit a solid wall of running out of water than we are hitting a solid wall of running out of fossil fuels. We can find alternative energy sources. There is no alternative water source. So it's very impressive that he's doing this dust mulching and not irrigating.
Okay, so Pat, where is his workshop this weekend?
No, it's not. It was last weekend. I attended it at the grower school.
Oh, okay, because I was wondering. I thought, does he have another one? I know we have the one coming up, a two-day event there in July.
July 9th and 10th. And that's, I want to talk about it a bunch because I'm really hoping that some people, even if they're not farmers listening, if they're gardeners listening, that they can talk to anybody they know that's trying to get started in farming, because I think this might be one of the more viable ways to farm for a beginning farmer. You know, it will involve a source of manure and animals will be the best, you know, and it's not a 1 acre farm. You're not doing this on 1 acre, you know, but if you've got 5 to 8 acres, and, you know, which is likely that it's family land, because what small farmer has that? But some people do have access to that, you know, and you can afford a tractor and some equipment. Now, what Jeff does, like any farmer that's been in business a long time, is he accumulates tractors when he can find a good buy on one and makes it a dedicated cultivator, a dedicated chisel plower. So he doesn't have to spend a lot of time swapping out equipment. Beginning farmers are just going to have to give up that time because they're not going to be able to afford 3 or 4 or 5 tractors, you know. But it's a very viable system, I believe, for farmers that are trying to make it without a lot of resources. I mean, you can't do this for free, but it's way less expensive to do this kind of farming than the kind of farming that we're looking at, which I still kind of believe is ultimately going to be better for building soil. But I don't know how much better. And if a farmer can't stay in business, what good is the system, you know?
Right, and having those more sustainable financial models is how we get the young generation into it, right, and find ways to be more efficient and do things more in tune with nature, and also for a higher profit margin to be able to do it well for the long term. I know, you know, young people, they aren't going to be attracted, you know, in some of the old models of being barely profitable, if profitable, and I'm so glad there's guys like Jeff out there leading the way with some great, great different ideas.
Well, and the irony is all of his methods come from 1930 agronomic journals.
Right, going back in time.
He
sits around reading 1920s research of agronomist things and stuff. That's right. What E. Murphy was saying, yeah.
Yeah, he's doing what he calls old-timey farming. This has been figured out before. What he's added in that is cutting edge is the biodynamic component. Because biodynamics, although reductionist science would never recognize it, is deeply tuned in to the microbial life of the soil, you know. And that is critical to being sure that your system is building fertility rather than mining the soil, you know. Pretty fascinating. I was totally turned, and I love those kind of workshops. When I go to a workshop like that and it makes me rethink everything, that's just exciting, you know. I don't think, like I said, that I'm going to be abandoning the concepts of no-till, but I have to leave room for other systems and then think about comparison, you know. And I can see a model where farmers start with this, and then as they build their sustainability, slowly work into no-till. The thing about no-till is it's going to help us to sequester even more carbon, you know. But Jeff has got, you know, the critical biodynamic thing is a completely closed, integrated system. And by having those cows raising his own hay, he's got a closed system. His fertility is coming from his farm. And that is the future of farming. And whether it's no-till, low-till, or major cultivation and tillage like he does, but very smart, savvy, you know, microbial ecology tuned in tilling. Any of those systems, I think, are the wave of the future.
So, Pat, I am not aware of, can you describe briefly how a chisel plow works?
It basically has a shank and then kind of a sweep on the bottom, and it goes down deep into the soil, kind of pushes forward, and then snaps back. And as it does that, it opens up a channel. It kind of chisels the soil open quite deep, you know, 10 inches, a foot, 14 inches, you know? And what that does is let loads of air in. Now, he's piled compost on top. It's dropping down into those troughs. He readily admits he's slicing up mycorrhizae, but he goes in one direction only. So all the mycorrhizae in between these channels, they're still alive, and they can grow right back out, recolonize roots. So he has rapid repair, you know, turbines, but he's using a system that allows rapid repair, getting loads of air down in there with loads of organic materials, really boost microbial activity. And very specific, you know, biodynamic microbial activity, which is, they've, you know, reductionist science, their head spins when they look at it. But I look at their systems and I understand why, using those systems, they're going to have different kinds of specific microbes. You know, they're using what would seem to a scientist to be bizarre systems. I mean, burying, you know, fresh cow manure in the head of a just killed cow, you know, burying it in a cow horn, you know, burying yarrow flowers in I forget what, but, you know, just all these different purposeful containers buried in soil, left for a year, taking it out, and they're obviously selecting, you know, there's another thing we talked about, indigenous microbes, not EM, not effective microbes, but indigenous microbes. Places like Korea, they bury brown rice underneath certain trees and things to capture the indigenous microbes. The biodynamic people are taking it one more step. They're not just putting a generalized stratum like rice out there. They're creating an incredibly specific environment so that the right microbes show up, you know? And they're not trying to figure out which ones they are, you know? They just know that over time, in tradition, these microbes, when combined, right, they take all these things, put them in a combined thing, and then bury that for a year, and that's called barrel compost, and that's this incredibly dynamic mix of microbes, you know? And so they have a totally uncharted by science but dynamic combination of life that they use in this system where they are rupturing the soil somewhat, but doing it in a way that can quickly repair and in a way that it is saturated with this very special life. And that's, you know, biodynamics is, I have been blown away by biodynamics for a long time. I'm beginning now to finally, at 65, understand how it works and respect it quite a bit, you know. And it really fits into the fact that I think I've said many a time on this show, sometime about 2-3 years ago, I decided I'm at odds with reductionist science. If they keep doing what they're doing and keep, like, threatening us with stupid food safety stuff and telling people that, you know, what they're doing isn't scientific so that people don't do good stuff, then I might find myself at war. You know, I might actually be doing trials and challenging them. But right now I'm at odds with reductionist science, and that totally fits my embracing a serious look at biodynamics. Because as I've said before on this show, biodynamics works. You can see that it works, and it is so inexplicable scientifically.
Right, and as we well know, Pat, right, we cannot wait to take apart the world one molecule at a time to figure out how to understand it and quantify it and measure every last drop of it until there's one, not even a heartbeat left, right? We've got to be realizing how far behind we are in the wonders of nature, and just how things work isn't always just readily apparent. But when we see that they work and we see the efficacy, we see how beautiful the growth is. I've been amazed. The most beautiful farm growth I've seen of plants. Just, it was like everything was supernatural. It was at a biodynamic place, and they had all of the energetic systems in place, and it was like a movie. It was like watching Avatar at somebody's farm. Everything was glowing. Even the butterflies were just calm. They were just looking. It was like, yes, you're in heaven. This is heaven. The most beautiful farm. And it was Philosophy Farm on the farm tour several years ago. Beautiful stuff. And, you know, we might not fully understand all the ins and outs of why biodynamics works with all the mysterious sort of things that goes into it. But it's worked for a long time. And I love hearing about Jeff's innovations with that chisel plow and bringing it to a little larger scale.
Right. Well, and he then does other cultivation, too. Like I said, his philosophy is he's got, like, let's say 8 fields. All of them are planted with the corn, which he's dying to get in, right? The last time it rained, as soon as it dried out, he came through, cultivated the top surface, killing any weeds and creating this, you know, layer of dry fluffy, which stops all the capillary action, holds the water in, so he doesn't have to irrigate, right? Now it's going to rain again. He wants to plant that corn. I'd run out and plant that corn and try and catch up later on. He's disciplined. He won't do that. First thing he does is do a final cultivation of all the other seven fields. So if it rains, he doesn't have a million weeds getting ahead of him, because it may rain for 3 weeks and he's going to lose his farm to weeds. So he's got a discipline. Then if at the end of the day he can get his corn and he gets it in, if not, the corn waits for the next dry spell. You know, it's pretty, you know, there's a lot of cultivation, but it's shallow. It's very intentional. It allows him to grow 100,000 pounds of food with three people because he doesn't have to worry about weeds. You know, it's pretty special. And what I would say to, like, not only can we not pull apart every last thing, science isn't even willing to do that. They can't deal with that. If I asked them to go out and look at why Jeff's farm works, they'd say, we can't begin to do that. It's way too many controls. There's not enough money for that. Nobody's going to pay for it. Monsanto's not going to pay for it. The government doesn't fund science anymore. No one will study it. And so we just don't want them saying, well, it's not scientific. You know, if you're not willing to look at it with your system and rigorously examine it thoroughly and then admit that you've discovered the different microbial systems that work, then don't tell us that. Don't talk to us about it. Just say it's a different way of farming and we can't judge it. You know, take away your indictment of it not being scientific, except that you are a limited theory, a limited system that will not look at complex holes. And there are some scientists that do. They are my favorite ones. They are not reductionist. You know, to quote Ray Archuleta, observation is science awesome. You know, Ray is totally willing to say, make scientific conclusions from observation. And he understands that nobody is ready to pull apart nine different cover crops, learn what the exudates are, learn why they work, and then learn why they work in synergy. And then look like, what happens if we take one out? What happens if we take two out? What happens if it's colder? What happens if it's warmer? That's too expensive for science. They have no interest in it. You know, they're funded by people that want us to use reductionist systems that are dependent on fossil fuel driven conventional agriculture. And we just have to agree to part ways. We need them to stop limiting us through the FDA and through talking to young farmers who haven't got their security yet, who are intimidated when they get told, well, that's not scientifically proven. You know, if it's not scientifically proven, it's not advisable. That's not necessarily true. Go see Jeff's farm. You might decide that's way more advisable, even though no scientists are willing to look at it.
Right. And then meanwhile, we're told things are safe that we know have not been safe for over 40 years. We've got, for the first time, a new study that is truly quantifying the cost of all of these poisons being spewed in our environment, the cost both to our soil and to our own health. And then we get the Senate confirmation of Dr. Robert Califf, who is very much in big pharmaceuticals, now heading the FDA. So, you know, the level of unfathomableness just gets off the charts sometimes with some of this stuff, the level of oxymoronic ironies that we are asked to swim in these depths of that make no sense, but yeah.
It would be a wild day in my perception of the world that a major player in sustainable ag, you know, or in natural foods, was appointed to be the head of the FDA. There are people out there that have the qualifications, but they will never be appointed that because the money says this is the way agriculture has to go, this is the way pharmaceuticals have to go, and that's not changing until we have a major shift in the power structure in America. And that's a different discussion. We don't talk about politics on this show, but we have to accept that we're going to keep, I guess he wasn't the head, but a major player, Michael Taylor, you know, Monsanto, you know. So if it's not pharmaceuticals, it's industrial ag. You know, one or the other is going to be a major player in the FDA. It's never going to be somebody, you know, from sustainable ag or from natural foods. We just don't have the power, and we have to always be in opposition. And that's a tiresome thing, but we will stay in opposition because we know what we believe in, and we are not going to have it taken from us because they're going to say it's not scientifically proven or it's unsafe by, you know, we're not using systems that are safe for food safety. We're going to prove, we're going to stay the course. We know what we're doing.
Well, we've got dozens of countries around the world totally getting rid of all this chemically based ag and banning GMOs and banning the cultivation. And it's happening all around the world. But of course, here we have the parasitic infestation in our systems going on, and we seem to be ignoring it. But this new head of the FDA was chancellor of clinical and translational research at Duke University until recently. He received money from 23 drug companies. And it's pretty amazing. But I see that as this model fails, as the toxic model fails, and we build more life, both in our soil and in our communities, that we can take back the millions of acres, over 125 million acres that are now being contaminated. Because around the world, it is already sweeping. It's just here in America, we've got this corruption going on, but I feel like, you know, it may take a while, but we certainly can turn it around. But yes, we're definitely on the uphill side of it right now.
Well, you know, we're on the uphill side, but on the other hand, the food movement is probably the most powerful social movement in America, you know?
It is.
And has accomplished more in 3 decades than I ever could have thought possible, you know? And, you know, similar things are happening on the health front. More and more knowledge is available. More and more effective healing is happening using traditional Chinese medicine, using homeopathy, which science, I mean, boy, you want to find something that science can't stand that makes them tear their hair out, it's homeopathy, you know? And yet another person, one of the folks down on our Florida farm, has just, I heard, started using the over-the-counter homeopathic remedies that I use for allergies, and she's off of her asthma medicine, you know? And she's using what science would say is nothing but a sugar pill. You know,
the only thing that really helped my allergies was the homeopathic remedies. It saved me. I was on the phone with the emergency room. I can't breathe. I mean, I literally never had a reaction until I came up here with all of the trees, flowering, biodiversity I'd never been around in my life. And I couldn't catch a breath. And that homeopathic bioallergy formula, the tree pollen formula, and I actually have some homeopathic remedies right here on my desk from Dr. Frank King, and some health remedies, and really, truly profound. It's that small bit of compounds that it takes to inspire our own immune system, our own functionality, and that's what really works instead of suppressing symptoms. Similarly with the gardening and farming, right, to encourage nature's natural systems rather than hammering them with chemicals. So, yeah, it's quite a mirror that we have going on with our personal and planetary health.
It's true. And, you know, the glory of it is we can just keep doing it, showing each other it works. We're just doing end runs around them all the time, you know. I mean, I have been personally responsible probably for the improved health by getting away from really traumatic allergy problems for probably several thousand people by now over the 30 years or so that I've been using that one homeopathic remedy. I share it, you know, with anybody that I see symptoms, and a huge number of people take it on and are immediately get relief, you know? And that's, you know, any number of scientists would tell me that can't possibly work. You know, there's no way it can work. But, you know, I know that my partner and I barely even have to use the remedy anymore. We're largely cured, you know, after using it for 15, 20 years. Now, the only time I even need to use that remedy is if I walk into a cloud of grass pollen. And then, which is really bad because I don't remember to keep it with me anymore because I'm basically cured. So I can still be severely traumatized. But then I immediately grab it and remember to have it for the rest of the season, you know. And that's just one example. The examples are endless of, you know, systems that are not, that rely on whole biology to get that it's the whole, you know, pharmaceuticals use this. They're looking at nature. They're copying nature for most of their drugs, but they're always about pulling out the one thing that's in there, adding a bunch of their own stuff in it so they control it, and then selling it to you, you know? And that's a recipe for side effects and, frankly, a recipe for less effectiveness and often for severe side effects. So we're just going to keep doing what we're doing, Lisa, and let nature be our guide, you know? And with weather like this, it's pretty easy to trust that it's all going to work out, even though, you know, there's a bunch of bumps in the road. We'll take those bumps and we'll keep going forward.
All right. Well, it's so great to know nature still works as far as things growing and sprouting and everywhere we look, right? I'm loving all of those. What are those? Pink magnolia?
Deciduous magnolia or the evergreen magnolia?
The bright pink flowers, you know, the fuchsia, the one that I told you froze everything the other year.
Yeah, I just know it as magnolia, but it's the evergreen magnolia. It's the southern one.
Is that just breathtaking? Yeah.
Yeah. We also have the deciduous one, which makes a similar flower, but not nearly as many of them, and they're usually high up, so they're harder to see. You know, it'll come in a little later, you know. But it's a native. It's in the wild here, you know. Anyway, I want to just briefly mention some things to make sure people are starting, a little bit of scheduling, and then I got to sign off. I'm a little late for a meeting, but I guess I'm just going to be a little late because I couldn't get to the get on air as quick as I wanted to. But I want people to remember that if you haven't got your own seedlings of brassicas, spinach if you want to grow it, beets if you want to do them from seedlings, lettuces, onions, check out the farmers markets, those that are starting early. See if there are any available there, you know. Look around, see if you can find some seedlings, get those, harden them off, protect them if you haven't got them hardened off, but get them in the ground. If you don't have those plants, you can direct seed all those things still. You're going to want to warm your soil up. You're going to want to have it weed-free. You probably want to use row cover over it. But it's not even too late to start onions. You're right on the cusp. If you don't get them started, I mean, immediately, it's too late. But you could take a shot at it. You could still pull them off, you know. All those other things, all those cool weather crops, get some soil ready so you can plant some carrots in the immediate future. Stale bed for a little while. Try to get them in the ground by mid-April. Grow the fast ones this time of year so they're mature before we get the heat and humidity and they start getting all those nasty diseases. Fast ones are things like Nelson, Yaya, Mokum, you know, Kinko. Those are the quick ones. Don't go for those long season ones. Those you plant towards the end of May so they grow through the entire summer. They get hit by the disease. They taste terrible. But then when they get into the cool weather, they get their good flavor back. They're huge and wonderful, you know. You know, get a bed, stale bed it, so sometime in late April, early May, you can sow parsnips. They'll be incredible by December. You know, you can plant them later for later in the season, but you can get them in now, you know. Now's the time, if you want to try and use a little bit of protection to get an early start on tomatoes, if you're going to aim to plant them out May 15th or a little after May 15th, you'll wait to plant them. But if you want to try and put them out towards the end of April using a wall of water or some other system of row cover and fabric, I mean, in plastic or something, then you want to start them now, you know. Start them in a bigger cell, maybe a 72, so they're nice sized when you put them out. And if the weather is real cold, you can step them up. You know, I'd hold on peppers and eggplant unless you're going to be doing them in a greenhouse. We're doing those in a greenhouse. We already have peppers started. I'm starting eggplant today, you know. Also, you could be starting some of your flowers, calendula, bachelor's buttons, sunflowers. Sunflowers can take a light frost. Delphinium, larkspur, all those things you can start right now. You're a little late for some of them, but they'll still do okay. If you were going to use protection by the end of next week, I'd say start things like zinnias and cosmos and stuff like that. They'll take 5 weeks or so to be a good size to plant out. That's going to be early May. And then you use row cover, bring them along so you're covered up with flowers early in the season. You can also be starting basil if you got a greenhouse. If not, cilantro, parsley, dill, borage, chervil, chives. If you don't have your perennial herbs, it's a good time to get divisions and start those. It's time to get things going, my friends. Absolutely. When you're not outside in the garden, be inside in your propagation system getting stuff going. Remember, go to seeds. Seed starting, the first one on that where you can see how to do a light system, how to have a germination chamber, heat table. We can teach you how to do it all. Start your own plants. It puts you in control.
Well, people are appreciating it, Pat. I've gotten calls from all over the country and even some calls from overseas asking about seeds. I've been pointing them to that video, and people are really enjoying it. I've gotten some wonderful phone calls from folks and some comments lately. And one very brief other quick question. I have some seeds. I'm not sure if they need to be frozen or not or what, but if I have some seeds that were left out, and I know it's not the best way to store them, but if I throw them in the freezer, how long do you recommend keeping them in there before getting them out for them to have the effect they need to have gotten frozen?
What kind of seeds are these?
Oh, just a variety of seeds. I mean, I'm just terrible. I'm just terrible. You know, I have a whole box I forgot got left out.
Lisa, the reason to freeze them is to make them last longer.
Right.
They're not improved at all by being frozen. In fact, you're going to diminish them slightly by freezing them and taking them out again.
I thought at one workshop they were saying you get a lot lower germination rates if they don't go through a cold cycle.
Well, certain plants want a cold cycle. But if they're bone dry, that doesn't count. Their cold cycle needs to be moistened, and then I wouldn't freeze them. I'd refrigerate them, you know. Now, some seeds, like I think parsley might be one that need to rupture the seed cell a little bit before the coat, before they can germinate. And it's probably even more esoteric than that. They might want to be moistened and then frozen to get them to germinate, but they're very specific. You know?
Okay.
You'd want to look at somebody like Susan Ashworth or Nancy Buber to get the specifics about that germination. Now, I just left a flat of Chinese skullcap and rhodiola, I think that's how you say
rhodiola,
it.
Rhodiola, right.
Rhodiola. You know, I left them sitting out in the snow. I piled the snow up from our big snowstorm. It was right before then that I planted them. And they've been sitting out freezing and thawing for, you know, about 6 weeks. And then I stuck them in the germination chamber, and I just took them out, and they're all starting to pop. They needed that cold stratification. But they were specific herbs that had specific instructions to give them that kind of cold, you know, that freezing and thawing and that deep cold. Most of the common seeds, you know, brassicas, lettuces, beets, flowers, you know, most of those, they don't need that at all, you know.
Okay.
Some of the flowers do need it, you know. You got to read the thing, and we can try and go over that a little bit more thoroughly next week about some things that you, for example, Echinacea purpura doesn't need it. Augustifolia does need that cold stratification, you know.
Okay.
Milkweeds, some milkweeds and stuff need that cold stratification, you know. So it just depends on the plant.
Well, I will look up a chart of that and see if I can navigate that a little better. Any closing words that you'd like to leave with us today besides get going, because I know you've got to head out for something, and it's definitely just time to get this all on in the seed starts and in the ground, right?
You know, it's really simple advice today. It's breathe deep and enjoy it.
Yes, if we can be enjoying the beauty while we're going wild with activity.
Don't let it stress you. Do as much as you can. Stay the course. It's a time for wonderful activity. It's energizing. This is what is supposed to happen this time of year. Everything is bursting out, and we are too. But remember to keep your health, and for it to be spiritually fulfilling, which gardening should be, breathe deep and enjoy it. Take a moment just to look around and take the wonder of it in, and then get back to what you're doing. But stay connected. It's a great time. And if you're connected, you're going to stay focused, and you'll actually do better. And boy, this advice is real important for me.
Oh, yeah. And I've learned to slow down, too. And you know, there really is something to it. And letting things come together, planning well enough to not have to run ourselves ragged. And you know what, Pat? I'm happy to announce I managed to get a whole population of ladybugs to stay alive all winter this time, and now they're all outside.
Well, see, I would have advised not releasing them all at once. Well,
no, I didn't. I've been letting them out a little
okay,
at a time,
great.
But it's been so warm, they're going bananas in here, so I've had to slowly be letting them, and I still have some in the refrigerator.
And try to let them out where there are aphids or other food sources,
right.
So they stick around. Otherwise, they're going to leave you and go looking for other food sources.
Oh, yeah. I've got stuff out there.
Okay, good. Well, I have to hit the road, so I'm going to say goodbye until next week, and...
All right. Well, we'll talk to Pat next week right here on This Week in the Garden with Earth Heart Network Radio. Always great to hear from Pat, and sending him along there, and hope he can do what he was saying about being a little more easy on himself, not getting too strained and burning the candle at both ends. Of course, it's an exciting time to do that. Daylight savings as well. I'm still frankly adjusting to that after the long weekend at Organic Grower School and then having to get up at what was 5 in the morning at 6 on Sunday after that big long weekend. So it's fun to have the daylight. Great to get the opportunity to get things planted. I encourage you to do that this week and every week right here on Earth Heart Network Radio. We'll get to talk to Pat next week. If you've ever got questions, you can email them to pat@livingwebfarms.org, and he'll get them answered on the air. We'll talk to you soon right here on Earth Heart Network Radio.